Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Christogenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, May 26th, 2023. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening we are going to present part 16 of our commentary on Genesis, and this is titled The Curse of Canaan. In our last presentation of this commentary on Genesis, we discussed the first three sons of Ham, of the sons of Ham, which are Cush, Mitzrayim, and Punt, as it was in Egyptian inscriptions. Now we shall discuss the youngest, or at least the last one mentioned, which is Canaan. As we had explained when we presented Genesis chapter 9 and thy father's nakedness, since Canaan was cursed as a result of Ham's having seen the nakedness of his father, as we read the account in Genesis chapter 9, then that phrase must have been a euphemism for another act, and therefore the birth of Canaan must have been a result of what is seen in the law in Leviticus chapter 20, where it says, in part, that the man that lieth with his father's wife has uncovered his father's nakedness. Having done that, we had also presented passages from Leviticus chapter 18, which further explain that the nakedness of a man's wife is also the man's nakedness. But we cannot imagine that Canaan was cursed merely because Ham saw his own father naked, as we had also explained with examples from Scripture, how in ancient times men had regularly seen one another naked even throughout the course of a typical workday, at least in certain vocations or activities. So that alone would not justify the curse of Canaan. But Noah certainly would have been justified to curse Canaan if Ham had violated his wife, which was also Ham's own mother, and if Canaan was the result of such a union. Subsequent events in Scripture also justify Noah's curse of Canaan, as Yahweh had upheld his words so that they became prophetic of the fate of Canaan. When Yahweh upholds a man's words, it is because the words are just and the man had uttered them righteously. This we read of the young prophet Samuel in 1 Samuel chapter 3, where we read, "And Samuel grew, and Yahweh was with him, and did let none of his words fall to the ground." And that's important, because we've all said things, and they haven't come true. We've all made promises that we didn't keep. We're sinful men in a sinful society, in a just society. When a man speaks, he means it, and when he speaks truth. So what he speaks turns out to be true. This leads us to reiterate, briefly, another issue, which is the alleged curse of Ham. Many commentators and theologians have claimed that Canaan's curse was actually Ham's curse, which is certainly not true. If Ham was cursed so that all of his sons would be servants, then Egypt would never have been a great empire, and would never have had slaves of the sons of Shem, such as the Israelites had been. But in turn, Egypt was never enslaved until Yahweh had explained in Isaiah chapter 43 that he gave up Egypt for the sake of Israel. That's when it was overrun with Nubians. Neither would Cush have been an empire, which had at one time ruled over the Assyrians and evidently others of the sons of both Shem and Japheth. And while many of the people of Cush were eventually amalgamated into later empires, the people of Cush were never systematically enslaved, but Yahweh had announced in Isaiah that he had also given up Cush. Some of the same commentators and theologians further believe that the sons of Ham were black because Ham was cursed, but that is not true. By itself, the passage in Genesis chapter 10 describing the empire of Nimrod refutes those claims, although there is also much historical data that refutes them. while some of Ham's descendants were later overrun with Nubians. Eventually, even countries which had originally belonged to the descendants of Shem and Japheth had also suffered being overrun with Nubians, especially those who were in league with the Arabs, who had both black slaves and black mercenaries and soldiers in their companies in the Islamic conquest of the medieval period. So punishment in that manner was certainly not limited to Ham, since Persia and Syria, the northern coast of formerly white Africa, most of Spain and Portugal, parts of southern Italy, Greece, Anatolia, Mesopotamia, and even the Caucasus Mountains, parts of southern Russia, and the Balkans were all overrun with Arabs and later by Islamic Turks. Nations surrounding the Balkans were vassal states to the Turks for significant lengths of time, even if they were not completely overrun. The Islamic conquest introduced both Canaanite and sub-Saharan African blood into many of those areas, so that in the end, Aram, Asher, Lud, Elam, and others had really fared no better than Cush, Mitzrayim, and Phut. Just as Yahweh had told the children of Israel in Isaiah chapter 43, that I gave Egypt for thy ransom, Ethiopia and Sheba for thee, he had also told them in both Jeremiah chapters 30 and 46, that though I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, yet I will not make a full end of thee. As Paul of Tarsus had written in Romans chapter 4, it was ultimately intended that Abraham should be the heir of the world. There are always questions concerning the fates of many of these Genesis 10 nations, as most of them are no longer recognizable in this modern world. While Abraham had special promises from Yahweh God, which Jacob had inherited, the other Adamic nations had a different relationship with Yahweh, even if they were also his children. Thus we read in the words of Paul of Tarsus in Acts chapter 17, speaking of Yahweh, that he made from one every nation of men to dwell upon the face of all the earth, appointing the times ordained and the boundaries of their settlements, to seek God. If surely then they would seek after him, then they would find him, and indeed he being not far from each one of us. The one in that passage is a reference to Adam, whose seed had survived through Noah. And therefore Paul was only speaking of the nations which came from Noah, which we see here in this chapter of Genesis. Having said these things, Paul had also alluded to Deuteronomy chapter 32, where we read, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. The division of the nations is described here in Genesis chapters 10 and 11, and all of these nations are the original white nations of antiquity. So, in the promises to Japheth that he would dwell in the tents of Shem, and even in the subsequent history of Ham, as there were promises that the children of Israel in their dispersions would take captive those who had taken them captives. It wasn't only the Assyrians and the Babylonians who did that. It was all of the nations of Mesopotamia, the Levant, and Anatolia who were in league with the Assyrians and the Babylonians. There were even Greek mercenaries in the armies of the Babylonians as they besieged Jerusalem. It was a wide world. The Assyrians and the Babylonians did not act alone. They had all of these subject nations who were tributary to them, who in turn had served them and supplied them with soldiers that gave them the ability to defeat Israel and Judah. So there were promises that the children of Israel in their dispersions would take captive those who had taken them captive. Yahweh may have had mercy upon some Japhethites and even some Hamites for them to be taken along captive with Israel in the dispersions. Israel taking them captive. But none of the modern and independent white nations can be positively identified with any particular tribe of the ancient nations of either Japheth or Ham. If there survives a remnant of Ionians in Greece, or in Meshach, or Tubal in Russia, for examples, then that is wonderful. But it cannot be determined with any degree of certainty. The modern white nations may indeed contain elements of these other Adamic tribes, and they surely do, but tribal identity is passed down through the paternal line. When the sons of Noah were divided into their nations, there were no Celts, Germans, Scandinavians, Italians, or Poles, nor any other nation in Northern Europe. There are some archaeological discoveries of people in some of those lands in more ancient times, but prior inhabitants are not necessarily ancestors, and the more ancient races left nothing of substance which lent itself to the founding of European culture. Rather, the European nations which had not come from the Japhethites had later come, and chiefly, from the seed of Abraham. While Ionians, Lydians, and Tartessians, for example, had survived well into historical times, by the time of Christ, the world had been dominated by the descendants of the children of Israel, in the Mediterranean by the Phoenicians, Romans, and Dorian and Danan Greeks, in the Near East by Parthians and Scythians, and in Northern Europe by the Sakae and Galatahe, the German tribes which came from the Israelites of the Assyrian deportations, as well as some tribes identified as Proto-Celts, of which the earliest of them were mainly Phoenicians. While it is beyond the scope of this Genesis commentary to prove all of this, it is in papers at Christogenia, but it is rather necessary to mention it in order to explain the fate of the other Adamic nations listed here. So now we shall focus on Canaan, as his descendants have a significant role in subsequent history, but certainly not a positive role. Genesis chapter 10, verse 15 is where we terminated our last presentation. And Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth. Only these two sons of Canaan are mentioned personally, and all of the names of Canaanites which follow are only of tribes or regions rather than of specific men. So the nature of how those tribes or regions or the people populating those regions, which are nine in number, are related to Canaan is not provided explicitly. It is plausible that Canaan had only two sons, and that all the other Canaanite tribes mentioned in the subsequent verses had come from these. But there are other factors involved which we shall discuss further on, at the end of this presentation. Sidon, the eldest son of Canaan. The name Sidon, which is often spelled with a Z, Zidon, and that's because it begins with the Hebrew letter Tsadi, which is a TS sound, that's very often transliterated into a Z, even sometimes in Greek, but usually into an S in Greek. So the name Sidon means catching or hunting, as it is related to the word which means hunter, or as a verb describes the act of hunting, the verb with the word which means hunter, I should say, is simply Sid, like S-I-D, and I would probably see Strong's transliterate that as S-I-Y-D, because it's the Sadi, and then a Yod, and then the Dalet, or D. As a verb, it describes the act of hunting. Evidently, Sidon had given his name to the city on the coast of Palestine, which is well attested in scripture. Ancient Sidon is approximately 20 miles north of the site of ancient Tyre, and on the coast at approximately the same latitude as Damascus, which is just over 50 miles directly to the east. A Lebanese Arab city, which has retained the name, occupies the site today. The ancient city Sidon is often called a Phoenician city, as it lies on the coast which the Greeks had later called Phoenicia. But that does not mean that its Canaanite inhabitants were the same as the settlers of Europe, whom the Greeks had also called Phoenicians. The Greek poet Homer had written of events which date to the early 12th century, but he did not put them into writing until the late 7th century BC, which is when he lived, as many as 500 years after the fact. Around 700 years before the Greek writers first mentioned Phoenicians, the Canaanites of Tyre and Sidon and the rest of the coast were supplanted by the children of Israel, who had then inhabited those cities. So in the earliest European literature, which is Homer, Sidon is mentioned several times in both the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer. But Homer never mentioned Tyre, a fact which Strabo also noted, and apparently there was good reason for that. Strabo said it explicitly that Homer never mentioned Tyre. According to Flavius Josephus, who had access to the ancient chronicles of Tyre, which are now lost, now that year on which the temple began to be built was already the 11th year of Hiram. But from the building of Tyre to the building of the temple, there had passed 240 years. While Tyre is mentioned in Scripture as early as Joshua chapter 19, where it was part of the inheritance of the tribe of Asher, it was evidently not yet a notable port until it was built up in the middle of the Judges period, 240 years before Solomon had built the temple. And that would be no earlier than the time of the Trojan War. So it is evident that Tyre was not yet a famous port in the period of which Homer was writing. Many years later, Herodotus would explain that, Strabo, I believe, would explain that all of the Phoenician colonies of Europe would come from Tyre and not from Sidon. Strabo had attested that now, although the poets have referred more repeatedly to Sidon than to Tyre, and this is where he says Homer does not even mention Tyre, yet the colonies sent into Libya, or Carthage, and Iberia, as far even as outside the pillars, outside of the Straits of Gibraltar, and there he's referring to the coasts of what we know today is Portugal, France, Britain, where they mine tin, and Ireland. And he says, as far even as outside the pillars, and Strabo was familiar with Ireland and Britain, him rather the praises of Tyre. In other words, they celebrate Tyre and not Sidon. So they were Tyrians and not Sidonians. In Judges chapter 19, Sidon was described as having been in the territory of the tribe of Asher, as well as Tyre. Both of those cities were in the territory of Asher. Earlier, in Judges chapters 1 and 3, it is explained that the various tribes of the children of Israel, who had been occupying the land of Canaan, had failed to exterminate or drive out all of the Canaanites from many of the places which they had been allotted, including Sidon. But Tyre was not mentioned in that context, so it was very likely not populated with Canaanites. Then, as it is also explained in Judges chapter 3, the Canaanites remaining had been placed in bondage under tribute to the Israelites. Subsequent chapters throughout the book of Judges describe the process of the defeat of the Sidonians and other Canaanites, and the survivors having been made tributaries to Israel. That situation persisted throughout the kingdom period, And we read in 2 Chronicles chapter 8 that as for all the people that were left of the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which were not of Israel, but of their children who were left after them in the land, whom the children of Israel consumed not, meaning didn't exterminate as they were commanded to, them did Solomon make to pay tribute until this day. They were slaves to the children of Israel in fulfillment of the curse of Noah. I should say partial fulfillment. There were others. The fact that the Sidonians had been under a state of tribute to Israel for at least most of the time in which the children of Israel had occupied the land of Canaan precludes the possibility that they were the dominant Phoenicians of the same period known as the so-called Golden Age of Phoenicia. And as Strabo had attested, it was the Tyrians who had founded the Phoenician colonies. Then Herodotus, who referred to the Judeans as the Syrians of Palestine throughout his histories, had attested that both they and the Tyrians were circumcised, both the Syrians of Palestine and the Tyrians. Citing that very passage of Herodotus, Flavius Josephus attested that Herodotus was speaking of Israelites, where he had written that there are no inhabitants of Palestine that are circumcised, excepting the Judeans, meaning Israelites, and therefore it must be his knowledge of them that enabled him to speak so much concerning them. The golden age of Phoenicia ended with the deportations of Israel, although the island city of Tyre persisted until the time of Alexander, and the earliest surviving Greek poets began writing around that same time as the deportations. The Phoenicians were indeed Israel, but in the writings of the Greek poets and historians, and in the period of the New Testament, Phoenicia was merely a geographical distinction. From the time of David, it is evident that the children of Israel had occupied all the coast of Palestine, from the land of the Philistines as far north as Hamath in northern Syria. In 2 Chronicles chapter 7, we read, "Also, at the same time, Solomon kept the feast 7 days, and all Israel with him, a very great congregation from the entering in of Hamath," which is the ports of Hamath on the Levant, "unto the river of Egypt." Earlier, in the time of David, where we read that he had a census conducted, in 2 Samuel chapter 24, both Tyre and Sidon were among the places where the Israelites were counted. In the time of Elijah, the prophet visited the Israelite woman of Zarephath, which belonged to Zidon, or Sidon, and dwelt there for a time. Even later, in the time of Jeroboam II, a king of Israel in the early 8th century BC, when the Assyrians were beginning to conquer Syria, we read in part that he restored the coast of Israel from the entering of Hamath unto the Sea of the Plain, according to the word of Yahweh, God of Israel, which he spoke by the hand of his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, who was of Gath-Hepher. So there should be no doubt that during the time of the Golden Age of Phoenicia, when they had been establishing themselves along the coast of Europe and Africa, the children of Israel had occupied the coasts of Phoenicia, while the Sidonians and other Canaanites were merely under tribute. Sidon continued under tribute to various empires throughout the Roman period until it was conquered by Arabs. That Canaanites remained among the local populations throughout that period is clear even in the New Testament. In the account of the Canaanite woman mentioned in Matthew chapter 15, whom Mark had identified from a Roman geographical perspective as a Syro-Phoenician, as it is in the King James Version in Mark chapter 7, and where I have, throughout the Roman period, I should say the Hellenistic and Roman periods. Sidon was always just under tribute, even throughout the Persian period. Heth, Canaan's second son. Heth is the eponymous ancestor of the ancient Hittites. The Hebrew word Heth means terror or to be afraid, but according to Strong, it is derived from a root word meaning to be prostrate or break down. The name of one of David's mighty men, Uriah the Hittite, should have been translated according to the meaning of the term, Uriah the Terror, since he was a brave warrior, and he was actually an Israelite and not of the descendants of Heth. That's absurd to imagine that David had an actual Hittite as one of his 30 mighty men. The Hittites may also be identified with the ancient Hittite Empire. However, it is arguable as to what degree that empire was actually Hittite. The earliest known inscription of what is identified as the Hittite language is said to be the Anita text, or the Proclamation of Anitas, A-N-I-T-T-A-S. One prevalent theory in relation to this text, and the first appearance, as I should say, as it represents the first appearance of the Hittite language, or I should say perhaps the earliest known appearance of the Hittite language, is that in order to write in their own language, the Hittites had borrowed and adapted the cuneiform writing system and other devices from the Assyrians in the early 2nd millennium BC. There were no examples of Hittite writing before this text, which is dated to about 1750 BC. But the resulting Hittite language, as it is known to archaeologists, is not classified as a Semitic or as a Hamitic or Afro-Asiatic language by modern linguists, as they now usually classify ancient Egyptian and Ethiopian, the languages of Cush and Mitzrayim, or Cush in Africa, I should say, and Mitzrayim. The Proclamation of Anitas, dated to the 18th century BC, deals with events leading up to the founding of the Hittite state and is the earliest genuinely historical text found at Bogoskoy. I don't know how to pronounce that. Bogoskoy, B-O-G-A-Z-K-O-Y. Bogoskoy is the site of an ancient Hittite capital, Hattusa, the city of the Hatti in central Anatolia. But in their own documents, the Hittites of the time of Anitas, when the empire began, considered their city of origin to be Nessa, even though the Hittites had conquered that city as well as Hattusa, the capital city of the Hatti or Hattians. Pithana, the father of Anitas, is said to have conquered Nessa before him. Pithana was said to be from another nearby city, Kusara, K-U-S-S-A-R-A, which seems to evoke the name of Cush, but I couldn't make a direct connection, so it won't be in my notes. The site of ancient Nessa is modern Kultepe in central Turkey, which is said by archaeologists to have been continually inhabited since about 3000 BC and to have been populated with Hattians, Hittites, Hurrians, and an Assyrian merchant colony during the early years of the Assyrian Empire, the first Assyrian Empire, really, that they had sent out merchant colonies, similar to the Roman colonies, but the Roman colonies were more for cultural and military reasons. The Hattians, who seem to have been Hittites, are distinguished from Hittites by archaeologists and also, apparently, in earlier Hittite documents. Although the Hattians were incorporated into the Hittite Empire. But the original language of Hatti is not the Hittite language of the empire, and it is not classified as either Semitic nor Indo-European. The language of the Hittite Empire is classified as Indo-European, and in Hittite inscriptions, it is called Nesili, the language of Nessa. Language is never a determinant of race, anyway. However, these political distinctions of the second millennium BC are rather late compared to the time of the sons of Noah, but they are also within reach of Moses, who was educated in the house of a pharaoh and who wrote in the 15th century BC, at the height of the Hittite Empire. However, Moses only mentions Hittites as one of the tribes of Canaan and makes no reference to the Hittite Empire, which already existed to the north and west. The Egyptians were well aware of the Hittites, however, and had been making treaties with them. In a treaty from the time of Ramses II, which is the early 13th century BC, we read in part, "Now from the beginnings of the limits of eternity, as for the situation of the great ruler of Egypt with the great prince of Hatti, the god did not permit hostility to occur before them through a regulation. But in the time of Muwatallis, these names, these Hittite names are crazy. In the time of Muwatallis, the great prince of Hatti, my brother, he fought with the great ruler of Egypt, Ramses Meriamun, is the brother. But hereafter, from this day, behold, Hattusilis, the great prince of Hatti, is under a regulation for making permanent the situation which the Re and Seth made for the land of Egypt with the land of Hatti, in order not to permit hostility to occur between them forever." And the hostility mentioned here centered on the famous Battle of Kadesh, which was fought between Egyptians and Hittites in northern Syria. Kadesh is a town near the Euphrates River, I believe, in northern Syria. The Hittite city of Carchemish, which was on the Euphrates River just north of what is now the Syrian border, seems to be identified where we read in Joshua chapter 1 that every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given unto you as I said unto Moses, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, even unto the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and unto the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your coast. Yet even Carchemish is said to have been inhabited by Hurrians in addition to Hittites, and we will get to the Hurrians a little later this evening. In the introduction to ancient Near Eastern texts relating to the Old Testament, we read in part that almost all Hittite texts which we possess come from ruins near the Turkish village Bogazkoy in the center of Anatolia. The ruins represent what is left of Hattusa, the capital of the Hittite Empire, which flourished between 1800 and 1200 BC. I will narrow that to 100 years, by 100 years. The texts are written according to a custom which the Hittites adopted from the inhabitants of Mesopotamia on clay tablets in cuneiform. They once belonged to archives or libraries buried under the debris when Hattusa was destroyed about 1225 BC. And that destruction, as we shall see shortly, was actually from an earthquake. Continuing the citation, this means that all of them are older than this date. A more exact date can be assigned to those which were composed by or in the name of specific kings. Now, this is followed by a list of 9 Hittite kings who ruled for about 200 years until 1225 BC. The Hittites in Carchemish and Palestine are mentioned in Assyrian inscriptions as late as those of Sargon II, Sennacherib, and Esarhaddon in the late 8th and early 7th centuries BC. The fall of the Hittite Empire is generally described to have been due to the so-called Sea Peoples, a name assigned to a loose confederation of tribes, as they are perceived on the surviving inscriptions of the Egyptian pharaoh Merneptah, who ruled at the end of the 13th century BC, and other records. The source of these Sea Peoples, who made raids against the Hittites, as well as the Egyptians and others, is often debated. However, the earliest Greek writers describe the Phoenicians as having had supremacy of the seas throughout that entire period, and we would identify the Sea Peoples with them, but include also the Philistines. As early as the Song of Deborah, recorded in Judges chapter 5, we read the prophetess lament in part, "And why did Dan remain in ships? Asher continued on the seashore and abode in his breaches." The word for breaches in that passage refers to ports in which ships could find harbor. So Asher had occupied the port cities of the territories which fell to that tribe, including Tyre and Sidon. Another factor which led to the fall of the Hittites of Anatolia and Syria are earthquake storms, which are believed to have occurred towards the end of the 13th century BC and to have lasted for several decades, in which Hattusa seems to have been destroyed, as well as other cities in Anatolia and the regions of the eastern Mediterranean and Aegean Seas. Earthquakes across Turkey, Anatolia, for several decades, I think about 60 or 70 years. All of my sources are in notes here in the written form of this presentation. So all of the sources there, and if they're available online, all of the appropriate links are there, including and a link to that article concerning earthquake storms, even though I had it in my own notes for the last 20 years or whatever. I think this is the first time I actually got to use it. I really think it. So sometimes it's worth keeping stuff around forever. I still have that magazine. In scripture, during the kingdom period, the Hittites are mentioned only as late as the time of Solomon, where they were described as having been under tribute to Israel. Although the context there likely means to include only the Hittites of the Levant. After the fall of Assyria and the destruction of Nineveh, the Egyptian pharaoh Necho attempted to take Carchemish for Egypt, an event during which Josiah, king of Judah, was killed, which is mentioned in both scripture and by the Greek historian Herodotus. But he called Josiah simply the king of a nation whom he called the Syrians of Palestine. The Hittites are mentioned again in Ezekiel in a warning to the people of Jerusalem, which seems to indicate that some of the people of Judah had already mingled with Hittites. And I won't repeat it. Your mother, speaking to Jerusalem in general, your mother is a Hittite and your father was a Canaanite or something along those lines. Now moving on to discuss the other tribes, which are said to have been Canaanites, even if no patriarch is mentioned explicitly in verse 16. And the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zemarite, and the Hamathite. And afterward were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. I ate dinner to recently before the presentation. Where it says, and afterward, perhaps it means that after these families had become prominent among the Canaanites, they had branched out into other places, especially since at least some of these names belong to cities rather than to particular tribes, while others do belong to tribes. Some of these tribes appear frequently and are well known from Scripture, so our discussions of them shall be relatively brief. Because we actually do have a lengthy discussion here on the Hivites, lengthy, perhaps 3 or 4 or 5 paragraphs. I don't remember. Even though I just typed it this afternoon, I don't remember. I'm sorry. The Jebusites were the Canaanites who inhabited Jerusalem, which is attested to at least as early as the Judges period, where ancient Jebus is identified as Jerusalem, the name given to the city by Israel. That's Judges chapter 19. But Jebus was not taken from the Jebusites by Israel until the time when David was made king. 2 Samuel chapter 5. The word Jebus is defined in Strong's Concordance to mean trodden, trampled upon. After the Hittites, the Amorites were much more prominent in history than the Jebusites or most of these other tribes of Canaan. Strong's defines the name as having been derived from the Hebrew word amar, which means to say, but which has a wide range of secondary meanings. The Assyrians called the lands west of Mesopotamia the land of Amuru, their word for the Amorites. Amuru is mentioned in very many Assyrian inscriptions. They had established a presence and ruled over diverse places at various times in antiquity, competing with the Cushites, Assyrians, and others. For some time, they ruled Babylon. And in the introduction to the Code of Hammurabi, as it is published in ancient Near Eastern texts relating to the Old Testament, we read in part that Hammurabi, also spelled Hammurapi, A-P-I instead of A-B-I, was the 6th of 11 kings in the old Babylonian Amorite dynasty. He ruled for 43 years, from 1728 to 1686, according to the most recent calculations. They're all over the map with the dating of the ancient Near East. The date formula for his second year, the year he enacted the law of the land, indicates that he promulgated his famous law code at the very beginning of his reign. But the copy which we have could not have been written so early because the prologue refers to events much later than this. There is speculation often repeated that this Hammurabi was the king of Shinar mentioned in Genesis chapter 14 by the name Amraphel. However, as we hope to demonstrate later in this commentary, when we once again become concerned with the chronology of Genesis, Hammurabi was about 100 years too late for that association. In the list of old Babylonian kings, Hammurabi is dated to begin his rule circa 1792 BC. I should call that the commonly accepted list of old Babylonian kings. And it's only very recent, most of the scholarship behind it. It's used to be a very different chronology, as we shall soon see. If the commonly accepted list of old Babylonian kings is accurate, Hammurabi is dated to begin his rule circa 1792 BC. If, as Paul of Tarsus had explained, it was 430 years from the call of Abraham to the giving of the law at Sinai, then the events in which Abraham had participated in that chapter of Genesis could not have been long after 1880 BC, in chapter 14 of Genesis. The Brown Driver Briggs Hebrew Lexicon makes the association with Amraphel, of Genesis chapter 14, but places the reign of Hammurabi circa 2100 BC, which is far too early for the time of Abraham. As we have stated earlier, often the name used for a foreign king is not what that king would call himself, and sometimes it is a word or phrase descriptive of the king from a peculiar, critical, or even hostile point of view. However, neither Strong's nor Brown Driver Briggs attempted to assign a meaning to the name Amraphel, and Jesenius speculated that it is derived from Hebrew words which mean word or speech. And I couldn't. There are Hebrew words that have that meaning, that Amar is the same meaning as Amorite. Perhaps Amraphel means Amar, and whatever Raphael might mean in his language, and this is speculation, it's a digression, it's not in my notes, but I might add it in, I doubt it. Perhaps Amraphel itself means Amor after the Amorites, something. Raphael, I don't know what that would mean in Hebrew, but that's also a strong possibility. Using the tribal name, maybe Raphael is a title. Okay, that's speculation, but it's better than Jesenius would do, in my opinion. As we hope to discuss in reference to the dating of the Amorite kings of Babylon, the popular dating seems to conflict with certain statements here in Genesis relating to the life of Abraham. But by the same dating for the rule of Amraphel, around 1595 BC, the Amorite kings of Babylon came to an end, and Shinar was overrun and Babylon destroyed by the Hittites. By 1570 BC, the Kassites, or Chaldeans as they are better known in history, who were evidently allied to the Hittites in that event, had come to rule Babylon. We have already associated the Kassites with Cush and the Empire of Nimrod, so it is apparent that they had really only managed to assert control once again. In Assyrian inscriptions, the land of Amurru was generally a land which stretched across northern Syria from the Euphrates River to a portion of the coast of the Mediterranean Sea north of Sidon. It was also evidently equated with the land of the Hittites, as it is in an Akkadian inscription dating from the time of Esarhaddon in the early 7th century BC and titled The Substitute King, because that is who it addresses, where we read in part, "This eclipse, which the moon brought about in the month of Tebet, concerned the land of Amurru. The king of the land of Amurru will die. His land will diminish," or in another interpretation, will disappear. "Surely the scholars can tell the king, my lord, something about the land of Amurru. The land of Amurru means the land of the Hittites and the land of the Suteans," or in another interpretation, "the land of Chaldea. Someone or other of the kings of the land of the Hittites, or of the land of Chaldea, or of the land of the Arabs, must bear the consequences of this sign. For the king, my lord, there is to be contentment. The king, my lord, will achieve his desire. The rites and prayers of the king, my lord, are acceptable to the gods. Either the king of Cush, that has to be the Cush of Mesopotamia in this context, or the king of Tyre, or Mugalu, wherever that is, must meet the appointed death, or the king, my lord, will capture him. The king, my lord, will diminish his land. The women of his harem will enter the service of the king, my lord." They weren't very picky back then, I guess. "The king, my lord, should be gratified. In this inscription, Hittites are associated with Amorites, as they are here in Genesis chapter 10, but the origins of the Sudians are obscure, and they may have been a division of the Aramaeans. Also, the Cush mentioned in the inscription must be the Cush of Arabia and Mesopotamia, or a remnant thereof. It could even possibly refer to the Chaldeans, who came to power in Babylon once again after the passing of the Assyrian Empire, which was not long after that inscription, less than 80 years. The next in line of these Canaanite tribes are the Girgashites, another tribe whose name Strong's original concordance had declined to define. The Girgashites are only mentioned several times in Scripture, always in relation to the land of Canaan, but only as late as the time of Joshua. They're not mentioned in the book of Judges. Following these are the Hivites. Strong's defines this name only as villager, and says that it is perhaps from another word, which is a word meaning life-giving or living place, and that word is chavah. It's very similar to the word translated as Eve in Scripture. While we are certainly not compelled to agree with the association, perhaps it is better to understand that the entry for Hivite should not exist at all. Well, the word Hivite appears in about 24 verses of Scripture. There are no historical Hivites outside of Scripture. But there is a prominent group related to the Hittites and other Canaanites, which are known as the Hurrians, and which can be identified with the Horites of Scripture. Whereas the Horites are otherwise unidentifiable until the name first appears in Genesis chapter 14, where it is associated with Mount Seir. Later, in Genesis chapter 36, it is evident that Esau and his descendants had dwelt at Mount Seir and had become amalgamated with some of the Horites there. In Genesis chapter 36, verse 2, we read that Esau took a daughter of Zibeon the Hivite to wife. But then from verse 20, we read, "These are the sons of Seir the Horite, who inhabited the land, Lotan, Shobal, and Zibeon." Zibeon's a Horite. He's a son of Seir the Horite. "And Anna, and Dishan, and Ezer, and Dishan. These are the dukes of the Horites, the children of Seir in the land of Edom." Further, from verse 29 of that same chapter, we read, "These are the dukes that came of the Horites, Duke Lotan, Duke Shobal, Duke Zibeon, Duke Anna, Duke Dishan, Duke Ezer, Duke Dishan. These are the dukes that came of Hori, among their dukes in the land of Seir." So it is evident that Zibeon the Hivite was actually a Horite or Hurrian, that the word Hivite is an error for Horite. The word Hivite, properly Kivite with a hard CH in Hebrew, but that's very often translated into just an H in English and in Greek, where it's often not translated at all because the Greeks only use a mark above the vowel to mark an H. They don't have a letter to equate that sound with. The word Hivite, properly Kivite in Hebrew, is three letters. CH, or the Hef, as it's called, V, or the Vav, and Y, or the Yod. So that's three letters, CHVY, or HVY, if you will. Hivi, which is Hivite. While the word Horite, or Korite, if you will, is Hef, Resh, Yod, or CHRY. There is confusion between the letters Vav and Resh elsewhere in Scripture, just as there is also sometimes confusion between the Daleth, or D, and the Resh, or the R. In Genesis chapter 36, that confusion is fully evident. This confusion is also apparent when comparing the Masoretic text to the Septuagint, the Greek of the Septuagint. In Genesis chapter 34, verse 2, where Hivite was interpreted as Horite, and also in Joshua chapter 9, verse 7. In each of those passages, the Hebrew word, which appears as Hivite in the King James Version, was translated as Korahias in Greek, Korahias, which is the way in which Korite or Horite would be spelled in that language. So that's two more examples, aside from Genesis chapter 36, where Hivite is a mistake for Horite. The Horites, which modern anthropologists and archaeologists call Hurrians, are well documented in Mesopotamia, Egyptian, and other Near Eastern inscriptions. Some Horites evidently dwelt at Mount Hor, which was also called Mount Seir, to which Esau had joined himself, as it was described in Genesis chapter 36. But the Horites also made up a significant portion of the Mitanni kingdom in northern Syria. In an ancient inscription, which dates to the 14th century BC, a treaty is recorded between the Hittite king, I said this name a few weeks ago, maybe last week, I forget, Supiluliumas, the Hittite king, and Kurtiwaza, the son of a dead Mitanni king who had to flee the country. He had to flee his country. The message also indicates that Kurtiwaza's mother was very likely a Hittite princess. There we read in part, and the Hittites were good at posting warnings at the beginnings of their inscriptions, and this is from the beginning of the inscription. A duplicate of his tablet has been deposited before the sun goddess of Arena, because the sun goddess of Arena regulates kingship and queenship. The Hittites were believers of two genders, but they had some sort of equality going on, I guess. That's all right. In a Mitanni land, a duplicate has been deposited before Tesub, the lord of the Urinu. Okay, it's okay. I won't go there. It means a treasury or shrine. The translators aren't positive about the translation. In ancient Near Eastern texts relating to the Old Testament, when they're not positive about the translation of an ancient Sumerian or Akkadian or Hittite word, then they will just leave it spelled phonetically in a text, but they won't attempt to translate it. So, in the Mitanni land, a duplicate of the inscription has been deposited before Tesub, the lord of the treasury or shrine of Kahat. At regular intervals shall they read it in the presence of the king of the Mitanni land and in the presence of the sons of the Hurri country. Then, in the closing lines of the treaty, we read, if, on the other hand, you, Kurtiwaza, the prince, and you, the Hurrians, fulfill this treaty and this oath, may these gods protect you, Kurtiwaza, together with your wife, the daughter of the Hatti land, her children and her children's children. Also you, the Hurrians, together with your wives, your children, and your children's children, and together with your country. May the Mitanni country return to the place which it occupied before. May it thrive and expand. May you, Kurtiwaza, and your sons, and your sons' sons, descended from the daughter of the great king of the Hatti land, and you, the Hurrians, exercise kingship forever. May the throne of your father persist. May the Mitanni country persist. The beginnings of the Mitanni kingdom. And I'm sorry, I should have said Kurtiwaza's wife, was very likely a Hittite princess. It seems that that is when she was given to him in marriage. That's how it seems from that wording. The beginnings of the Mitanni kingdom, which, like the Hittite empire, was a state rather than a nation. A nation being properly a tribal entity. The Mitanni kingdom beginnings are obscure, as are the nature of its ethnic components. However, from the inscriptions of the Hittites, there should be no doubt that the Horites, or Hurrians, were a significant portion of its population, and that Kurtiwaza and his father also seemed to be Hurrians, but who had also intermarried with the Hittites. What follows is from a book titled Constituent, Confederate, and Conquered Space. During the 15th century BC and the first half of the 14th century BC, Mitanni was a powerful kingdom. The state ruled over a large area from the upper Kabor. Later on in history, the children of Israel are brought to the Kabor by the Assyrians. That was one of the places where they were settled by Assyria, was in Kabor, which the King James Version calls Habor. So the state ruled over a large area from the upper Kabor to the middle Euphrates, from eastern Anatolia to northwestern Syria. Unfortunately, we have only very few Mitannian sources concerning the political organization of this kingdom and its relations to subordinate states and polities. We have even less information about the early history of Mitanni, that is, about the events that brought about its formation. This intriguing topic may be of some interest in this workshop, which deals specifically with the transition from the Amorite to the Mitanni period. Mitanni is mentioned for the first time in an Egyptian source, the Thebes grave inscription of the state official, the Egyptian state official, Amenemhat. He recalls having participated in a military expedition on Syrian territory, and in this context, the country of MTN, which is believed to mean Mitanni, is mentioned. Although Amenemhat served under three pharaohs, Amos I, and Clifton and I both believe that that was the pharaoh of Joseph, Amenhotep I, and Thutmose I, it is generally thought that this Syrian expedition coincides with the one led by Thutmose I, 1493 to 1483 BC. There is still substantial disagreement regarding the time and the historical context in which the state of Mitanni was formed. Two hypotheses have been put forth and continue to be upheld by scholars, although with varying motivations and reasoning. And I will repeat the hypotheses. And one line in conclusion. Mitanni was already a powerful kingdom. This is the first hypothesis. I'm sorry. Mitanni was already a powerful kingdom at the end of the 17th century or in the first half of the 16th century BC. Thus, its beginnings date to well before the time of Thutmose I, dating instead to the time of the Hittite sovereigns, Hattusili I and Mursili I. Early Hittite kings. 2. Mitanni emerged from a political vacuum in Syria, which had been created first through the destruction of the kingdom of Yamhad by the Hittites, and I'm not familiar with that kingdom, and then through the inability of Hatti to maintain control of the region during the period following Mursili I's death. The inscription of Amenemhat would therefore be one of the earliest pieces of evidence that the Mitannian state had become a political entity of some importance. The author says, clearly the problem is even more complex because our inability to establish an absolute chronology for the period in question, both for Hittite history as well as for the history of the entire ancient Near East. And I was glad to see that admission, I really was, because some datings are off by a lot. And modern datings have reduced the chronology by quite a bit, which I don't necessarily agree with. That explanation of the possible origins of the Mitanni Kingdom, which was also actually an empire, hopefully exhibits some of the challenges inherent in piecing ancient history together from inscriptions discovered and deciphered by archaeologists. The admission concerning chronology is also candid, as we would challenge many aspects of modern popular chronologies of the ancient Near East. However, modern academics do not take the scriptures seriously, as if they know more than the men who lived 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. But it is clear that Hurrians were the predominant population of the Mitanni Kingdom, which was once to the north of Israel. But around the same time, they had also occupied a portion of what had later become Edom in the south, as well as having been found throughout Canaan. The next tribes in order of the Arkites, the Sinites, or I should say some of the next tribes in order. These next five aren't quite in order, I'm sorry. Of the Arkites, the Sinites, and the Zemarites. Nothing is known specifically about any of these groups, since their names appear nowhere else in Scripture but here in Genesis chapter 10, and in a copy of this same genealogy provided in 1 Chronicles chapter 1. Perhaps the Sinites lent their name to Sinai, or perhaps they were named or called here from Sinai, as the two words in Hebrew are very close. However, that is only a conjecture. I didn't want to go through a Bible map and just take shots in the dark trying to line these names up with cities or regions. That's just conjecture. I don't like wasting time like that. However, the Arvadites and the Hamathites are identifiable, as Arvad is the historic name of an island which lies a mile and a half off the coast of the northern Levant, although it is only less than a half mile long and not as wide. And the Arvadites should be associated with the Canaanites of that area, between the Sidonians and the Amorites. Likewise, the Hamathites may be associated with Hamath, the city in northern Syria, which in David's time had become the northernmost extent of the territory which he had gained for Israel. The original Strong's Concordance also makes that association. Ancient Hamath would have been in the shadow of all three of the more dominant Canaanite tribes at diverse times. I should say, perhaps, at the crossroads also. The Hittites, the Amorites, and the Horites. Now, finally, we may conclude the Genesis chapter 10 passage on the sons of Ham and Canaan with verse 19. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, as thou comest to Gerar, unto Gaza, that's all the way down south near Egypt, as thou goest unto Sodom and Gomorrah, and Admah and Zeboim, even unto Lasha. These are the sons of Ham, after their families, after their tongues, in their countries, and in their nations. This may have been the original border of the Canaanites, as they were first distributed after the events which are described in Genesis chapter 11. Those events did not take place, as we hope to illustrate, for over 500 years after the flood of Noah, or perhaps not much later than 2700 BC, which is only an estimate. Much of this land was destroyed in the days of Abraham, of which we read later in Deuteronomy chapter 29. The whole land, therefore, is brimstone and salt and burning, that it is not sown, nor beareth, nor any grass groweth therein. Like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim which Yahweh overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. While Lasha is only mentioned here and elsewhere in Genesis, in chapter 14, the cities of the plain destroyed along with Sodom and Gomorrah are Adma, Zeboam, and Bela, or Zoar. Bela is said to be also Zoar, but Lasha seems to be Laish, which is the city that the tribe of Dan in the north had later conquered and taken for themselves. And I'm persuaded by that because if we look at this description of the land of the border of the Canaanites, from Sidon, we're at the north, and we go all the way south to Gaza, and then it goes east to the shores of the Red Sea, the Dead Sea, where we have Sodom and Gomorrah, and then it says, even unto Lasha, I'm convinced that is Laish, because we have to get back north to draw the rest of the border. So there you have it. This may have been the original... So the land which was later divided among the tribes of Israel was roughly contained to this same land. And just as the Canaanites had overflowed these borders, so did Israel begin to do that same thing almost as immediately as they had divided it. But the consequences of the curse of Canaan are made evident in Genesis chapter 15, where the same land is described to Abraham, and we read, in the same day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. As far as the Canaanites overspilled it, so would the Israelites. The Kenites, and the Kenizzites, and the Cadmonites, and the Hittites, and the Perizzites, and the Rephaims, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. While we do not know who Canaan had married, evidently his descendants had mingled at a very early time with the Kenites, which are the descendants of Cain, the Rephaim, which are a portion of the Nephilim, the so-called giants of Genesis chapter 6, which are actually the fallen ones or fallen angels, and several other groups or tribes which are not listed in the genealogy of the sons of Noah. They are the Kenizzites, the Cadmonites, and the Perizzites. Recent lexicons attempt to define some of these names as Smiths in reference to the Kenites, and it can mean that, but that doesn't mean it means that here, or Easterners, or villagers, or as people dwelling on clayey soil. But those attempts are all absurd. If some of these names are clearly names describing particular tribes, then they are all names describing particular tribes, since anyone may be a Smith or a villager or live on clay soil, and anyone may choose to be a Smith. Here it is fully evident that at an early time, the descendants of Canaan mingled with the Kenites and the Nephilim, and subsequent scripture corroborates that fact. One example is Og of Bashan, a king of the Amorites who himself was described as one of the Rephaim, but whose land was called the Land of Giants. It may be imagined that Kenites and Nephilim had similar influence throughout all the lands of Canaan. If Canaan was destined to be inferior to all of his brethren, a fate to which the curse of Noah had him doomed, that may very well explain why he resorted to these tribes, which were apparently all related to the Nephilim, since they did not descend from Noah. As for the later Canaanite empires, they were all short-lived. The Hittite Empire, which was isolated and rather unchallenged in the rough and typically colder mountains of central Anatolia, had lasted less than 500 years. The Amorites ruled Babylon for only 300 years. The Mitanni kingdom seems to have lasted less than 200 years. Once they had each passed, the peoples whom they represented had never become great again, even if they now exist under other identities and they serve as a scourge to Christendom. The academic historians credit earthquakes and the sea peoples with the fall of the old Bronze Age societies of the Near East and the decline of these Canaanite powers in and around the 14th century BC. And Egypt also began its own decline around that same time. What they should credit is Yahweh, the God of Israel, who is making a safe space for his people as they conquered the land of Canaan and the surrounding area from the river of Egypt and north to Hamath and the river Euphrates. The fact that the Canaanites had mingled with tribes of the Kenites and Rephaim also reveals their nature and the inherent reasons for all of their perversions, which are described in the land of Canaan, and further justifies Yahweh, the God of Israel, who had commanded the children of Israel to exterminate them all to the last man, woman, and child. When the children of Israel failed in that mission, Noah's prophecy that Canaan would be a servant race was fulfilled, but that also ignited a long chain of events which resulted in the woke society of today and the modern rebirth of ancient Sodom and Gomorrah. This we shall discuss in greater detail when we come to Genesis chapters 14 and 15 in this commentary, Yahweh God be willing. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.